Coming up on this week's show, Teletext Worms is real.
A 90s classic finally gets a proper sequel.
And we talk gaming manuals in 2023 with Rowan Fox Noble.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our brilliant friends at Bitmap Books. Now, coming this month, The Art of the Box. Now, this is a gorgeous 564-page celebration of video game box art, featuring interviews and the work of more than 26 artists from across the last four decades. You can find out more about that over the next few weeks. Check out that book and the rest of their collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 390, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Robbie Abbott.
And me, Joe Parks.
And very nice to be joining us for this week's podcast, whether you've been listening since the very beginning, 390 episodes ago. Wow. Or maybe you're a new listener. Welcome to the podcast. Every single Friday, we celebrate classic video games, classic technology. Basically, if you know this sound, then this is the podcast for you.
Hello. Anybody else want to? Yep.
You know, it's funny, when I was looking up that, obviously that was the Nokia ringtone. Weirdly, in Google, everyone refers to that as the Nokia Mozart ringtone. So I thought, I mean, I'm not really into classical music at all. So I thought, oh, Mozart must have made that. Done a bit more digging, though. It wasn't Mozart that made that song. It was a Spanish composer called Francisco Tárrega. And this is from Granvals.
You know what? We nice, joked last week about a fact of the week.
There you go, spitting facts every week. So
it's like when
podcast.
You start the computer up and it gives you a fact and it says, do you not want this tip next time?
Yeah, yeah.
check the little box.
So start a show tip.
Now.
But yeah, 390 episodes. I don't want to frighten you guys, but that does mean we are getting close to another big landmark on this podcast.
What,
I want to talk about it, I know.
I don't know what you're on about. We don't want to hype it up too much.
No, we never like to hype it up too much. I mean, you know, episode 400 is obviously in a couple of months away. I think they normally fall around October, don't they? Our centenary episodes, so we're getting close to that now. Already plans are in the works. I know a few people have kind of asked on Discord, what you got planned for it? We have got a few things lined up, you know, but obviously this podcast, we intend to keep it going well into the 400s and beyond. And of course, keep bringing you incredible guests. And you think by the time, you know, you get to like 400 episodes, I mean, there were people that, you know, in our first 10 episodes were like, oh, you guys are going to run out of guests soon. But there is so much to do with retro gaming and technology to cover.
There's so many areas and, like, just interesting chats you can have. And I think it's amazing that we've got to this far. You know, there's a great kind of history of episodes that you can check through. You know, we've had so many guests that have been on, but we've even had guests that have passed and stuff. And it's so important to kind of get these stories and... I just really enjoy doing it. I enjoy doing it with you guys and also chatting with all of the people online as well.
Yeah, we've got an incredible community around this podcast. So long may it continue. And of course, we'll bring you up to speed on what's been happening over the last 7 days in just a minute. But you mentioned there, Ravi, you like talking about, you know, all different things, all different facets of retro gaming and tech. What about gaming manuals? Because they were such a big thing back in the day. And obviously something that around the, I'd say, probably around the Xbox 360 and PS3 kind of time, that's when you opened game boxes and you found that rather than having a proper thick printed manual in there, it was generally just a sheet of A5 paper, wasn't it? They just kind of vanished, I guess, when online tips and tutorials came into gaming, but they were definitely a massive feature of video games back in the day.
Well, also, you say big there, some of the manuals were the biggest thing in the box. You know, you get a huge chunky manual, loads of weight on it, and then a couple of floppy disks. That's now it's kind of gone, sadly. You know, we talk about it on this interview. We've got Rowan Fox Noble, and he works for Manual Booklet Prints UK, which is a wicked little company that he started where he's kind of printing new manuals for Switch games and stuff. And these are amazing little pieces. And he talks about how, you know, companies are saying, there's been environmental problems with printing stuff. You know, they're also just releasing PDFs of manuals. You know, it's kind of, it's been removed from the video game world, but also, you know, even the Switch boxes have a space for a manual, and the little booklets that he creates are absolutely perfect to go in there. They look like they would have come with the original game. But he's not only just doing modern Nintendo stuff, he's doing indie games as well, which is really cool to see. And I got Joe on this interview, of course, being the resident Nintendo fanboy.
Oh, yeah, it was a really, really fun chat. You know, first half, kind of just being nostalgic with Rowan, which, you know, we really love. And kind of like you say, talking about classic game manuals and kind of like, he kind of started his journey around the N64, but I got some Super Nintendo chat in there as well. But honestly, these manuals that he makes and tip books that he does as well, little notebooks and stuff, if you opened up your Switch case and it had one of them in there, you would not question it. Like, they are absolutely fantastic. And it was just really, really fun chat. So I'm really, really appreciate you bringing me on that one, Ravi.
It's interesting coming from the kind of Nintendo wheel, because I know with a computer, we kept all the big boxes and stuff like that. But I do remember with the N64 manuals and stuff, and even the Game Boy ones, people would just chuck them out.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd just have the carts left loose and the manuals and the boxes would just get totally disregarded.
Joe's mum.
Yeah, my mum. say it every year or so, yep. But you know what? It's interesting, actually, because you just said there, Ravi, you know, Nintendo, SNES, N64, Game Boy, all cardboard, and a lot of them got chucked away. But big box PC generally got kept in quite good nick, and I don't know if that's maybe because they were just built a bit sturdier, because they kind of have a bottom tray, but, you know.
PC guys had shelves.
Yeah, PC guys had shelves, maybe, or just a little bit more sense about them, maybe. But yeah, interesting. I've never really thought of that before.
I wonder if it's because you'd install it to your hard disk on a PC and often wouldn't need the floppies anymore.
Oh, maybe. And you put the box away and maps as well and stuff. I used to remember getting great maps, and you only seem to ever get these things with like special editions now, and it's never with the standard. So it's great to see it, you know, coming back for 2023.
And I'm looking at his website, which is mbpuk.net. Some of the manuals that he makes. There's one for Metroid Prime Remastered in here. He's done Paper Mario, The Origami King, Animal Crossing. He's done a player guide to that as well.
The new Metroid Prime, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it does look like, I mean, are these, obviously we'll find out in the interview coming up, I mean, are these kind of officially endorsed? How does this kind of
work? Yeah, well, we talk about that. we talk about the legal aspects of it as well, because you know what Nintendo are like, but you're going to have to wait for the interview to hear about that, though. Right.
There's a teaser for you. So he's coming up on the podcast in around half an hour from now. This week's special guest, Rowan Fox-Noble of Manual Booklet Prints UK. Something we've definitely never talked about on the podcast before, but like we said, you know, it's really interesting to cover all aspects of retro gaming and the amount of memories I've got, mainly of trawling through manuals when, you know, you first get the game and you might be on the bus coming home and you couldn't wait to get it in your machine. You just kind of have a look through, wouldn't you always open it?
Or the pirate game where you desperately needed the manual. You didn't have it, and you had to borrow friends to work out how to actually play.
Yeah, or when you got the, type in word 12 on page 16 of the manual, and you're like, ah, okay, better go get a photocopy of that. Obviously, don't have to worry about that anymore. So he's coming up on the podcast in around half an hour from now. But of course, the first half of the show, that's when we kind of have a look back on what's been happening in retro from over the last week. And it has been a busy 7 days in the world of retro gaming, and this is a cute little story. Now, we did cover this a while back, that Team 17 did an April Fool's, didn't they, back in 2019, when they basically said there was a long-lost port of Worms that was designed to run on UK teletext systems. Now, back then, everyone was rather getting excited about it and thinking, oh, wow, there might be a version of Worms that's in like a... Teletext was kind of like ANSI art, wasn't it, really? Like, you got on bulletin boards. And then, in other words, you know, it was all a complete prank because it was released on April 1st. Everyone clicked then. It was like, it's made up. But it actually caught someone's attention, a programmer called Alexandra Group, who decided to make this into a real thing.
So this was from the demo sceners, and, you know, it's come from Evoke Party, which is absolutely awesome. A really, really good party in Germany. I want to go one day. And this is quite mad because teletext I always associate with the BBC computers. From what I've seen, you know, like people running demos like Bad Apple and stuff like that. I've always seen them running on like a BBC Master or on a kind of older system. But to see
that Mode 7 mode, wasn't it? That was made for teletext on the BBC Micro.
Yeah. And to see this running on an Amiga is pretty mad. Of course, you need a teletext enabled TV connected up to it, and you can actually play a game of Worms, which I don't know enough about this to know if this was technically possible back in the days or if it's kind of a novelty.
That's interesting you mentioned that, because I'm looking at this now. I didn't realise it actually used teletext on the television then. I thought this was just kind of displaying out of the standard Amiga.
No, you actually needed teletext-enabled CRT. Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy. So basically, it is a playable version of Worms that runs in teletext things. I'm watching this video now and it's got, you know, it's got suicide bombs in there. It's got the wind as well. You're controlling the characters and they've got the names above them. And apart from looking obviously very low res and 8-bit, like you said, Ravi, like a BBC Micro pretty much, this is a fully playable version of Worms. This is nuts.
Yeah, it is mad. And the thing about it is as well, it's obviously the screens have animation and interactive elements and stuff. And I remember when I used teletext, it was literally just, you know, with the remote, and there wouldn't be any of these effects. You wouldn't have anything like the water and, you know, the kind of cave landscapes. But for me, for some reason, it fits ideally with the graphics. Like, ooh, Worms looks really good in this. And I just have this mad image of, like, going back to the kind of 80s and, you know, implementing this and everybody playing Worms against each other in the UK.
Wow, yeah. That would have been like good. A massive network game. Yeah, that would have been awesome.
Yeah, probably impossible though. But just the idea that, you know, this is going to come out of the demo scene definitely, and just implementing this is it's really, really good fun, and it's just mad to see, isn't it?
Well, I remember when we had the Teletext Archivist on the podcast in the early days, didn't we, when we talked about restoring teletext signals from old VHS tapes. And that was an interesting chat as well, because the way basically teletext works is there are 312 lines in a PAL image, but the teletext signals are placed above that, aren't they, out of the range of the visible TV display?
Yeah.
So basically that's the way this is working then. The Amiga's just kind of displaying the output in that kind of normally hidden part of the display, and then the TV interprets that as teletext signals.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Maybe we're going to see more games come to teletext. I don't know if there's a Teletext Lemmings or
there needs to be.
Yeah, what other titles do you think would kind of fit teletext?
Bubble Bobble, like Buster Move.
Oh yes, yeah. Maybe the NES games would work really well.
Yeah. Maybe some Atari games, some Atari Pac-Man and ET. Get that on teletext.
2600 one flickering.
Yeah.
I do love it as well, though, that apparently you do control this with the Amiga's mouse. Because at first I was thinking, do you have to play it with, the remote control on your TV? but apparently not. You can use the Amiga's mouse, which is a bit of a relief. I didn't fancy playing that with.
Yeah, I guess it's just using the CRT as the teletext output, and then the Amiga as the actual driver behind it.
Yeah, I'm interested to play this, though, because I mean, I do have a teletext-capable CRT stored away, which I think it would be worth getting out to try this out. Because I'm wondering, obviously, you can watch the video, but I wonder what the latency would be like, because whether you're going to need games where you haven't got really fast responses to, like maybe something like Pac-Man wouldn't be that good.
It certainly looks very fast to me.
Yeah.
I've got a teletext-enabled TV, and I wanted to get a Raspberry Pi and have an output, where you can run CFAX or the old TFAX service on there and just have it to update news and stuff. But I've got an Amiga next to it. If I could connect it up for this, that's going to be wicked.
Yeah, so very, very cool to see. So basically, if you want something that you think is really cool, just make it an April Fool's, and then, you know, someone from the demo scene will make it reality in a year or two. So if you want to download that, Teletext Worms is available now to play on your Amiga and your Teletext TV. I'll link up that in our show notes. Now, here's a follow-up to a story that we covered back in February this year. Now, do you remember we were talking about this Atari Jaguar emulator, or Atari Jaguar for our friends over the pond. This is an emulator called a Big PEMU, or Big PEMU. Still not quite sure how you say that. But we did mention that this really fully featured Atari Jaguar emulator now has Atari Jaguar CD support built in. He baked that in back in February of this year. But there has been another big development as well. Now, it turns out that you can play there is only one of them, but you can now play Atari Jaguar virtual reality games on a modern system via this emulator.
If you're a fan of Missile Command and a fan of, like, extremely slow refresh rates and a big fan of Atari Jaguar, then this is for you. This is the story for you. So Yeah, this is really interesting. So this comes from Rich Whitehouse. And he, I think he created the big PEMU as well. And he was also responsible for the, you know, the unreleased headset for the Sega Mega Drive / Genesis that was kind of uncovered.
Yeah, the Sega VR.
Oh, we've got an interview soon where we talk about that.
Yeah. he was responsible for porting that and getting that working on like a HT Vive, which we went into real detail about. So now he's done the same with Missile Command for the Atari headset. The amount of work that goes into this, you know, to kind of like with the frame rates and everything, because of there's a lot of work, but it's way over my head. But, you know, kind of as in the refresh rates and kind of essentially having to slow it down and stuff like
and
that.
And like the tracking and stuff like that. Yeah.
The tracking and just it's absolutely mind-bogglingly. Mind-boggling.
Boggling.
There we go. Mind-boggling.
I like bongly better, though. That sounds
better. How much effort goes into getting this to run. And just the fact that he's able to get his hands on these demos and, you know, these prototypes and stuff like that. I mean, does he actually have the VR headset, do we know? Or does he just have the files?
Well, if you watch this video, yeah, I mean, but looking at it, he's basically just kind of reverse-engineered the code in Missile Command.
Okay.
To make it work on an HTC Vive headset. So, yeah, I don't think he's actually in possession of one of the very rare Atari Jaguar VR prototypes. But, yeah, I mean, the code's all in there in the games. All he has to do is kind of make it work in the modern headset, you know, via the emulator. Because, interestingly, I mean, there is only that one game that was made for the unreleased Atari Jaguar VR headset, Missile Command. And they did demo that at a couple of trade shows back in the mid-90s. And, there are videos on YouTube about it if you want to kind of see what it looked like. But this is the first time, because obviously back then, it wasn't really possible for them, you know, at a trade show to hook it up to a recording device. So you had to watch a guy with it on his head going, wow, this is cool. This is the first time I've actually seen what the effect looks like. Because in this video that I'll link up in the show notes, he actually demonstrates it with a screen capture as well, doesn't he? The kind of stereoscopic effect of it.
Yeah. And I mean, graphically, it reminds me of Where Did You Learn to Fly? What's that game called?
Oh, Cybermorph.
Cybermorph, that's the one.
Yeah.
Graphically, it does really remind me of that. It's totally Jaguar, you know, like Atari Jaguar, isn't it? But yeah, I mean, like you say, it's interesting to get that scope of what it actually looks like because of, as you say, back in what, 93, 94, we didn't see this, you know, like you say.
Well, there was a few prototypes like hanging around, but I don't think they were working. And, you know, there were bits of them. I remember at the Leicester Retro Computer Museum, they had one as well, Simon Marsden, who does, you know, the virtuality stuff, which was the Amiga based kind of 3D virtual reality system, like the old heavy one. Looking at this, I wonder, you know, obviously there's a limited selection of games. I wonder if he's going to put a mode in where you can kind of VRify other games. So, you know, like playing Alien vs. Predator in VR would be really cool.
That'd be really cool, yeah.
Well, because I did buy, and you guys know this, that I bought a headset off eBay. I think it was before Christmas last year, called the Dino Visor. And this is basically, I think, when Atari scrapped the Atari Jaguar, the technology. Basically, they sold the technology to this other company. I've got a feeling there might have been a Chinese company who made this. And they released it basically to work with just, you know, PCs, really. So I mean, most of the components that were in the Atari Jaguar headset is in this Dino Visor. So the only thing I think that's missing in there is kind of the head tracking. So it is possible to basically hook the Jaguar's output into the Dino Visor, which you can buy off eBay. I mean, I got mine for about 150 quid. So most of the technology is in there, but it just means you've got to look around with the controller rather than moving your head. You know, whereas the original Jaguar VR headset actually had the head tracking in there, I believe. But actually, he's managed to implement that using the modern HTC Vive. So you do get the full Atari Jaguar VR experience now via this emulator. So I do think it's very cool. I mean, obviously, there's only ever this one game and most people probably won't care about it. But I think having a look at kind of, you know, what the system was capable of, because if that had come out back then, I mean, I'm not sure whether it would have been a massive success, but it definitely would have been the first kind of home affordable virtual reality headset, wouldn't it? You know, decades before, like, you know, Sony. So, yeah, very, very cool to see kind of what could have been. So you want to check that out right now. And obviously you can download that on the emulation for your modern machine. I'll link that up in our show notes as well. Now, another follow-up to a story that we mentioned a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about the Micro Beast. You're quite taken by this, Ravi. This was a basically a kit computer, wasn't it? An 8-bit kit computer that you build yourself, kind of in the vein of the old Sinclair machines from back in the 80s, like the ZX80.
Yeah, I really liked it, and it was compatible with the RC2014 as well, and these kind of like little kit computers. And I quite liked it because it took it back to that kind of nostalgic, you know, building a computer, and thought it had a really good educational aspect to it as well.
Well, the guys behind that, which is FearTech.com, they've now released a, this is kind of an add-on for the Micro Beast, but also the same, this has got a lot of potential. This is a new video card called the Video Beast, which is compatible with a lot of the old 8-bit machines, like, you know, the Z80, 6502, 6809. It said, you know, potentially lots of other 8-bit machines as well. And really, this is a proper old school video card, isn't it? Because obviously that's one of the hardest things to do, you know, when you're building an 8-bit computer, or you want to expand your retro machines. You know, video cards are not only quite tricky to get hold of in good working order, or, you know, they often break down, or, you know, people have used them until they're kind of usable limits, but you can emulate that using stuff like the Pico or, you know, Raspberry Pi and stuff like that. But having a proper dedicated 8-bit video device for retro machines and for kit computers like this, I think it's a really cool little idea, and it's very small, this card as well, isn't it? I mean, you can fit this into the palm of your hand.
Yeah, it looks tiny, and it looks like, you know, it can be expandable and used on all of these different architectures, which is pretty cool. Like, I like the idea that you can get extra screen modes and stuff by just clipping this card on, and you can probably use it for multiple devices. But I guess, you know, obviously people are going to have to develop adapters for it and stuff,
yeah,
to have it kind of fitting in or hack it in themselves at the moment. But it's got stuff like one megabyte of video RAM in there as well. It's you know, it increases the colors as well. It's got some higher screen modes. I'm not sure I quite understand it, but to me it just looks like an old school video card, and that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's got, you know, fonts in there as well that are built in, bitmaps. It's got sprites on board too, you know, titling in there, 512 colors. It's got some older 4x3 resolutions as well, like 320 by 240 and 640 by 480, you know, for hooking up to proper old school CRTs. Do it like we used to. We can do 16:9 displays as well. So really, I mean, this is a device that I'm looking at right now. I mean, I haven't got a Micro Beast, but I'm thinking of this as kind of, it could be a video card add-on for several other machines. I mean, I'll be interested to see if people get this working with, like, you know, the BBC Micro or the Commodore 64, for example. And then, I mean, that kind of gives it a lot of possibility, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I'm looking. So it's got a thing called the host board, which is kind of clipped in. And, you know, the Micro Beast as well didn't have any kind of big output. It was displaying in an LCD, little screen, and well, LED basically, but this clipping onto it has a like VGA output as well. So I guess maybe you could implement other stuff in there, like a HDMI, or, you know, you can get custom boards. And this is probably going to develop a whole little market of these kind of clip-on ones. And it reminds me of when, you know, the Raspberry Pis first came out, and people were putting them in the BBCs as co-processors.
By that tube port.
Yeah, it kind of feels like those kind of early days, and then suddenly, you know, this is going to turn into something big. So I really like this idea. I think it's pretty neat.
Yeah, and I mean, we've talked before about what, you know, big fans we are of this kind of hobbyist scene, even though you know, some of this does look a bit too advanced for my kind of limited skills, you know, building a micro. But yeah, I think, you know, just seeing this stuff out there and the possibilities, and then, you know, we'll obviously wait until someone assembles them all and then just, you know, writes drivers, then we can use them.
Yeah, and cool. Also it looks like it's got a SD card interface built into there as well, which is pretty cool. So you can maybe use it for multiple things. You know, this might become an all-in-one kind of 8-bit add-on.
Yeah, looks very interesting. So it's a work in progress at the moment, but if you want to check it out, I'll put that and, of course, all the rest of the stories in our show notes at theretrohour.com, or check your podcast app. Now, we've got some very exciting news to talk about in a moment. Just dropped at the time we're recording this, something I've been hyped for many years. The Flashback 2 trailer has just landed, so we'll talk all about that in a minute. And some never-before-seen images from Sonic Extreme, that, of course, was that cancelled 3D Sonic game that was meant to come out on the Sega Saturn back in the day. So we'll chat about all that in just a minute. Before we do, let's take a second to give a massive thank you to this week's sponsor, and that is our wonderful friends at Notion AI. Now, we've talked about this before. I mean, Joe, you think about your morning when you go into work. You know, how many apps do you have to open on your desktop machine in the office?
I mean, I turn my computer on at work and I've got to go into OneNote. I've then got to open my Outlook. I then have to open my Gmail. I then have to open an app called CSM. I then have to open Excel. Then I have to open Word. I then have to open Teams. It keeps on going. I then have to log into, I can't go into it too much, but another 3 or 4 apps after that. It's pretty frustrating, to say the least. It'd be pretty good if I could put all of them, if not most of them, in one place.
Well, this is where Notion comes in now. Notion, the guys behind it realize that this is a nightmare for all of us. I mean, I'm the same, you know. Too many notifications as well. Your digital life is scattered across too many different places. I mean, you know, think of this podcast with Google Docs, email, yeah, you know, Dropbox, Trello, Discord, you know, all these different services that we have to log into and constantly update and everything as well. Well, Notion is a single space where you can think, you can write, you can plan. It captures thoughts, manages projects, even runs an entire company. And the good thing about it is you can do it in exactly the way you want. Think about how many different tools you currently use and maybe how much you pay for them each month as well. Trying to make them talk to each other can be a nightmare. Well, Notion keeps them all together in one tidy place. Just what you need in a world of too many tools, too many platforms, and too many notifications. So some of the things this can do, and it's really powerful. I mean, I've been playing around with this for about a month now, and finding this really useful. I mean, I've been using it to help me do YouTube videos and stuff recently. So you can do, like, you know, to-do lists on there, either individually or for your team as well. If you run a small company or even a big one, your company goals could be on there. You can put your planners in there, product descriptions, your marketing plans. And the good thing about it is fully multimedia. Embed images, videos, you can make gorgeous documents. You can even do like an internal team Wikipedia in there, product roadmaps, just a few of the ideas. And beyond documents as well, you can do databases to manage team-wide projects, track deals, onboard new employees, publish articles directly to the web. And one thing about Notion that I love right now is that they've actually got AI built in as well, and it's built into all their tools. So that means, you know, across your notes, your documents, your planners, you don't have to jump out into a separate tool. Because right now, I mean, if I want to use ChatGPT, I've got to come out of my word processor, hop in there, get it, do something, paste it back in. And this means you can basically automate all the tedious tasks in your day job while you focus on the things you're best at. It can help you with brainstorming, first drafts as well, even turn your messy brainstorming into a polished, finished document at the click of a button. So this is an absolute game changer. If you want a calm, clear place to focus on the things that matter, why don't you give Notion AI a try for free? Now, use our link. Of course, it really helps the podcast out by using our links for our sponsors. Head to notion.com/retro or lowercase notion.com/retro and try out the incredible power of Notion AI today. When you use our link, you're supporting the podcast, notionai.com/retro. And we say a massive thank you to our friends at Notion AI for their support of our show. Okay, our special guest, Rowan Fox-Noble of Manual Booklet Prints UK, talking about recreating video game manuals, bringing them back for the 21st century and modern platforms as well. He's coming up in just a moment. You know, something quite hyped about this, Joe, because I know we've talked before about kind of what could have been with the Sega Saturn. I mean, one of the biggest complaints was it didn't really ever get a proper Sonic game.
Didn't get a proper Sonic. It got Sonic Jam, it got Sonic R, it got Sonic 3D Blast, but none of these were, you know, mainline Sonic games or new mainline Sonic games, because obviously Sonic Jam was a compilation. And I actually saw a really interesting video on YouTube recently by Sega Lord X, and it was about would have Sonic Extreme saved the Sega Saturn. I don't think it would have, personally. I think there was too many issues there, but I think it would have made it do a bit better. I can't say Sonic Extreme looks like the killer app of the Sega Saturn, but it's definitely an interesting story, to say the least. And for those of you who don't know, essentially Sonic Extreme was going to be the main Sonic game of the Saturn, but it was actually being made by the Sonic US team rather than the Japanese Sonic team, because they were actually working on Nights into Dreams, which was a fantastic game. But Sonic Extreme, it's meant to be a 3D game, but it's kind of 2.5D game, isn't it? A lot of 2D sprites kind of in a 3D environment. Very similar to Sonic 3D Blast, but it's from behind view rather than like a
isometric view, and it kind of reminds me of a game called Cooler World, but a PS1, where when you move around the environment, like you kind of walk around the walls and you can walk on the ceiling and the game like flips and stuff, which is really cool. But the reason we're talking about this is three original, never-before-seen screenshots have been found of the game. And a lot of people get hyped about Sonic Extreme, you know, because there's not a lot out there. It really is there.
Yeah.
But this is all getting shared over social media and on a lot of, like, you know, Sonic forums and websites and stuff like that. But these are screenshots just kind of reveal a little bit more about the game, a few more of the worlds and enemies that would have been in there. But interestingly, these were screenshots which were meant to be for magazine publications.
Yeah, like press PR shots.
Yeah, press and PR shots and stuff. So, you know, screenshots of where the game is at in development and stuff like that. But just for whatever reason, because the game was cancelled or it was too soon to reveal them and stuff like that, it just never happened. I'm not too sure where these have been leaked from. I'm not too sure.
I don't think these have actually been leaked. This is from a Twitter account, an X account. I'm doing the X in my hand right now.
Right, yeah.
Called Sega Forever, which I believe is actually officially a Sega channel.
Okay.
So basically, it's one of Sega's social media teams.
Oh, okay.
Their retro tech team has basically shared this and said, you know, these were meant to be screenshots, you know, for magazines and stuff. Back then, you know, there was meant to be the real deal, original screenshots of the game in action that were ready for PR materials, but just never got out there. So this has actually come from Sega themselves by the looks of it.
I mean, brilliant.
I'm trying to get onto X right now, and it looks like Elon Musk hasn't paid his bill again this month because it won't load for me. But I will link it up when it gets back up again. But it is interesting. So, I mean, when I first saw these, I thought, has someone managed to get hold of kind of a bit more of the game than we've already seen? And, you know, then I got a bit excited, like, you know, if someone's got these kind of bits of the game we've never seen before, maybe there's a possibility some of it will be put out there so we can play it, you know, a bit more of a complete kind of version. But obviously it looks like this is just kind of, it's been in the vaults for several decades. Because, I mean, there were so many problems with Sonic Extreme. I mean, I think they started development of that in 1994, obviously when, you know, the Saturn was kind of just coming onto the market, and then it got cancelled around 1996, 97, I believe. So it was in the works for a good few years until they realised that basically they couldn't make it work. And then they didn't try again until Sonic Adventure with a, you know, proper 3D Sonic game. So it is interesting. I mean, do you think we'll ever see like either a recreation, or... It would be nice if Sega kind of
finished
this
like
off one
this.
Day.
I think the resolution on it is, and the texture mapping and stuff, gives a clearer picture of what it would be like. And to be honest, I would have probably bought a Saturn if this was on there. I had no interest in it if it didn't have a Sonic game on it, pretty much with the Sega stuff. Because I was still obsessed with Sonic. And, you know, I would have thought, Oh, they've finally done a new console and they've put a Sonic title out. Even if it was pants, I probably would have bought it.
Yeah, level-wise, it looks quite interesting. And you see some of the enemies in here as well. I mean, obviously, I'll link up these screenshots, one of a look for yourself. But, I mean, describing them on an audio-only podcast. But basically, there's three of them in here as well. And the stages look quite interesting. I think, you know, in terms of the visual appeal of them, I mean, obviously, you're working with very early 3D hardware, but there are kind of rings scattered around, and the color palette doesn't look all that interesting on some of them. I mean, they're quite kind of two-tone, aren't they? Like gold and black, or a green and gray.
It's quite muddy
in one of them as well. Yeah, it is. And it's interesting the way, I think this is one of the biggest problems with the game, that kind of getting the camera to work properly, wasn't it? So they're talking about, you know, a couple of the gimmicks that were in the game, being able to run up walls and the way the camera would follow Sonic as he kind of went up the wall, which obviously we saw, you know, that they did very well in Sonic Adventure. By the looks of this, I wonder how well it would have been implemented on the Saturn.
Yeah, the Saturn, it wasn't the best for 3D games, so I can't imagine the camera being that snappy.
Oh, look at Bubsy 3D.
I mean, that was PlayStation. Like that. But
you know, that period of 3D when they struggled to kind of, you know, get it going. And I guess if Team Sonic were like, no, then, you know, they had the high standards, and maybe it's better that they didn't release it. But, I would have bought any old Sonic crap back then.
I love the honesty.
Yeah.
I think it would have been nice, though, if, you know, maybe what is out there. Because, I mean, obviously, the fact that Sega is sharing this on their official social media channels means, you know, they know there's an interest from fans out there. It would be great, wouldn't it, if they... It would have been awesome, you know, if they ever do the Saturn Mini. Wouldn't it be great if they kind of finished it and put it on there?
That would be great. That is a good idea, actually. And you know what? I kind of want it to be like... Oh,
have that one, Sega. Have that one.
They're going to have that one. I kind of feel like, oh, Sega, they never do what the fans want. But then, you know, when you think about it, you're like, well, they did do a Mega Drive Mini, and they did do a Mini 2, and then they've been asking about the Dreamcast, and then they did do Streets of Rage 4. Like, well, they gave the rights out to Streets of Rage 4.
And a Mini Game Gear.
The Mini Game Gear, yeah, they did do that as well. So, never say never, and I guess they will have it in the vaults somewhere, you know, all the original kind of like, you know, files and everything of the game. So, you know, I don't know how far along it was, but it was pretty far along, but I don't think it was anywhere near the kind of final stages. But Nintendo did it with Star Fox 2. I mean, I know that was like that was a finished game. But yeah, never say never. Saturn Mini, make it happen with Sonic Extreme.
Yeah, so even if, you know, they don't ever do a Saturn Mini, I think even just having something like this in like a nice Sonic collection or, you know, being able to play it on the Switch or something like that, I think will be awesome. I think there'll be a lot of interest in that. I mean, obviously it'd be amazing if they actually made it available for the original Sega Saturn, but I think, you know, maybe some like limited run could maybe do that, but I can't imagine Sega ever releasing official Saturn titles again. But yeah, it would be great. I mean, I've got confidence that one day we'll see it in some kind of vein, so we'll obviously keep an eye on that. And it is cool that Sega are giving it some attention, though. So I'm going to check out those screenshots. I'll put them in our show notes as well. Now, going back to the 90s, I mean, one of my all-time favourite games, and I've talked about several times on this podcast before. I know you're a fan, Joe. I don't know if you ever played much of this, Ravi. This is a flashback, or to give it its full title, Flashback: The Quest for Identity.
I always found a flashback quite hard.
Yeah,
and I didn't get far. I always liked the intro and the kind of look of it, and thought, yeah, it, you know, it's a groundbreaking game, but I was always a bit crap.
Yeah, and it was kind of a cinematic platformer, I believe they called those games, like, you know, Prince of Persia, and obviously Another World came out a year before or 2 years before. And this was kind of the third kind of cinematic platformer game that I played. And I do remember a lot of hype around this in magazines at the time, people saying it was basically like I think they advertised it as a CD-ROM game on disc or on cartridge. You know, it was meant to be that advanced. And it had great cutscenes in there as well, that rotoscoped animation on the character Conrad, very much like Prince of Persia. Beautiful looking game. You're right, the Ravi, it was very difficult. I think the furthest I ever got on Flashback, I got to, there's a level, I'm not sure whether it's the last level or the one just before. There is kind of one that's in a, it's kind of a purple alien planet, and you've got these creatures that are a bit like the Blob.
Wow.
They kind of chase you around on it.
You made it a lot further than I did, Dan. Yeah. Because I was still messing around in the jungle.
May have used a cheat, if I'm honest, from a magazine or something back then to kind of see what it looked like. Never finished the game, though. I mean, I've since kind of, you know, watched it on YouTube to see what the ending of the game looks like. An incredible experience, though. And I mean, we've seen updates of it many times over the years. You know, I've got a version of it on my Switch, and, you know, there was the remastered edition that came out on the PS4 as well back in 2018. And there's been, there was actually a sequel to it back in the mid-90s on the PlayStation called Fade to Black, which it's weird because when I first played that, I didn't like it. And I've since kind of played it again, and actually it's kind of grown on me a bit more. I do think it is quite decent, but it's just, again, it suffers from that problem of, you know, it is early 3D, so the controls are a bit fiddly.
Yeah, I remember playing the demo for Fade to Black with my brother. God, was it 95? I think that came out.
Yeah.
And we thought it was going to be like Time Crisis. I don't know why. I think it was just because he had a brown jacket on, like in Time Crisis. And we played it, and we were like, even back then as kids, we found it so stiff and hard to play. You know, it comes back to what Ravi was saying earlier on about that, you know, bubbly 3D and stuff. It's that early 3D that doesn't really work. But it was funny because when you said, oh, the Flashback 2 trailer's dropped, I was like, Fade to Black? I haven't thought about that in like almost 30 years.
The reason we're talking about this is because the Flashback 2 trailer has just dropped. And I'm not going to be harsh, but this looks like every cyberpunk game that has come out in the past couple of years. So to me, it looks like, oh God, what was that big cyberpunk game that came out?
And Cyberpunk.
Yeah, that one. and also Stray.
Using the name.
Stray as well.
Yeah.
You know, you could literally replace this dude with the cat and there would be no difference. Yeah, and it looks like a very Unity game. I can see what they're going for. It could be good fun, but I'm so bored of this aesthetic. I'm just, yeah. Looking at the trailer, yeah. It doesn't thrill me. It might thrill you as a Flashback fan, though.
Well, they did do a kind of a modern update, an HD kind of remake of Flashback. I thought quite recently, I've looked it up, it was 10 years ago, it was 2013 when this came out, and I played that thing on the Xbox One. Wasn't gripped by that. I mean, weirdly, at the time, I remember that coming out and everyone like kind of hating on it. But I was looking up today, and actually it's got some quite positive reviews. So it seems to be a game that's kind of a bit, you know, take it or leave it. I wasn't a fan of that kind of modern update of Flashback. I much prefer the originals. But then, yeah, this is a proper sequel to the original Flashback game that I think we did cover on the podcast back in May 2021 when it was announced. And now, yeah, we've got the first look, the first trailer. They're calling this the new Washington trailer because you take a tour of the neon dystopian megalopolis of New Washington in this exclusive action-packed trailer for Flashback 2. Now, it's the same character, Conrad B. Hart, who I was thinking, though, the original game came out 30 years ago and he's about 30 then. I mean, it's quite, you know, the way he jumps and everything, he's quite athletic for like a bloke.
Well, wasn't it what you think he should be like wheezing and stuff, jumping over stuff? What wasn't the original one in the kind of jungle forest setting as well?
It started in it.
It started in it. Maybe starting on the edge of the city, if they do that. But, Satellite Rain was another game that I've played, which was a kind of continuation of Syndicate. It looks exactly like that. This whole aesthetic is like done to death at the moment.
I mean, looking through the comments on the YouTube video, a lot of people seem very hyped for it.
Oh, yeah. I think it's going to tick the boxes for the kind of nostalgic group and stuff. And I think it will sell and stuff, but it's not my cup of tea.
I mean, it's very, compared to the original game, it's very zoomed out.
Yeah.
So, you know, the original Flashback is quite a tight kind of shot, you know, of the character. Conrad seems quite in the distance for a lot of it. And interestingly, I mean, a lot of it is kind of the side-on platforming, you know, like the original game and kind of going through walls and doors and rolling on the ground, that kind of thing. But there are elements of it where it kind of switches into kind of behind, like third person kind of view, doesn't it? Where you kind of see over his shoulder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you kind of walk forward. So it's got a few different kind of gameplay modes in here. I must admit, it's a really short clip. It's like less than a minute. And I'm not really quite sure how I feel about it yet. I'd like to see more of it. I mean, there was the official reveal trailer that came out at the back end of last year, which really was just kind of cutscenes, really. It wasn't any of the gameplay in that. So this is the first time I've really sat down and looked at the gameplay. I mean, it looks like it will be a fun experience, but I'm not sure. I mean, you've got the climb up bits and stuff like that look like similar to Flashback. I just wonder whether it's going to feel like you're playing a Flashback game.
I prefer your version with an overweight, wheezing guy running through.
Yeah.
that game would appeal to me much for trying to kind of live in a cyberpunk society.
Yeah, I mean, it is cool that they're kind of revisiting this, and there's going to be like collector's editions like there is for pretty much everything now where you get, you know, a Conrad figurine, and there's a manual with it as well. We'll talk more about manuals in a moment. The original game comes with it too. They're bringing it out on the PS4, PS5, and Switch as well. Not sure whether there's going to be an Xbox version of it. It says PC too. Oh yeah, Xbox Series X and Xbox One. So pretty much all the modern platforms.
You know, I guess it's how it plays, isn't it, as a platform?
Yeah, that's the thing.
That's the key to it. If they've got that right, then it's sorted. Yeah, but the other remake, I don't think they did get that right from what I heard. But it was all about the precision, wasn't it? And the platforming on that game.
I think that was a problem for me with the 2013 version. You know, it looked gorgeous. You know, I thought that the graphics in it were nice. It just didn't feel like you're playing Flashback, which I think, you know, it's a difficult thing to explain the feel of a game, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd hope that, you know, the team behind this have kind of, you know, are familiar with the original and played it extensively to kind of capture that feeling of it. But we haven't got long to wait. It is going to be landing on all the modern platforms in November this year. Then the limited edition coming out in December afterwards as well. So if you want to check out that trailer, I will admit, I think I'll definitely watch a few reviews of this first, I think, before I go out and buy it. It might not necessarily be a day one.
Yeah, I'm the guy who predicted the Switch was a failure, so don't listen to me.
Yeah, we don't dwell on that, really. But very cool to see Flashback, the franchise continuing. So I'm going to check out that. And of course, everything else we talk about, you don't have to Google around. I save you the effort. I put everything we talk about in our show notes on your podcast app or head to our website at theretrohour.com. Okay, then we are going to be talking to this week's very special guest, celebrating Nintendo manuals, retro and new school as well, with Rowan Fox Noble. He's coming up in just a second. Now, before we do that, let's take a second just to give a big thank you to one of our longest running sponsors. That is our great friends at ExpressVPN. Now, think about when you might nip to the bathroom. You always close the door behind you, I'd assume. Maybe Joe doesn't, but the rest of us do. Because you don't want random passerbys looking up, looking what you're doing in there. So the thing is, when you're doing stuff online, why don't you protect your privacy there as well? Strange analogy, maybe, but that's what ExpressVPN is. Because basically using the internet without a VPN is like going to the bathroom and not closing the door. Because, I mean, your internet service provider, they know every single website you visit. And what's worse, we've heard stories about some ISPs, particularly in America, who are selling your personal browsing information to advertising companies, these big tech companies who are then using the data to target ads at you. I mean, we've all gone online before and searched for something, then suddenly next day, you're getting bombarded with adverts about that specific thing you were looking at. But ExpressVPN creates a secure tunnel encrypted between your device and the internet. So that means your online activity can't be seen by anyone, even your ISP. And we all use ExpressVPN. Rav, you even used it before they approached us, didn't you? You've been using ExpressVPN for years.
Yeah, I just have it turned on default. So basically when I start up my laptop, it just goes straight onto ExpressVPN. And it's great because, I end up going to hotels in other countries and stuff and connecting to Wi-Fi. You never know what their setup's like. You never know if people can sniff your traffic and stuff like that. So setting up is really easy and you can just do it on your phone, laptop. You can even have it on your router so your whole house can go through the VPN, which is just absolutely fantastic. And it offers that extra protection and, it's just one button, basically. You select your server, you go onto it, and it's very fast as well.
So we want you to try ExpressVPN for yourself, and of course we'll get you great offers. Try 3 months of ExpressVPN for free on a one-year plan by heading to expressvpn.com/retro, expressvpn.com/retro. Get those extra 3 months free and help out the podcast. And a big thanks to our friends at ExpressVPN. Right then, next, we're going to be celebrating the world of video game manuals, old and new, bringing them back for the modern age with our special guest, Rowan Fox Noble. He's coming up next on the Retro Hour podcast.
So you're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and we're here today with Rowan Fox Noble, and he is from Manual Booklet Print UK, and they are bringing manuals back in 2023. So how you doing, Rowan? You okay?
Hey there. Yeah, not too bad. Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Thanks for joining us. And we have a question that we always ask our guests, and this is the first question. Okay. What was your first gaming experience that you remember?
My first gaming experience, I do remember, actually. I think it was about 6 or so. It was getting the N64 with Super Mario 64.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember where. It was like a place that did just random videos, DVD. Well, no DVDs back then at the time. But videos and other sort of technical stuff. And my parents got the box, the N64 box. And, yeah, I remember setting it up and playing it and just being amazed, really, of how cool it was and trying to figure out how it all works and everything. It was it really just opened my eyes. And then the next game after that, Legends of Zelda Ocarina of Time, that was that got me hooked, really.
So you were definitely a Nintendo fan and of that generation.
I would say so. It's the only one that I really knew or really remember playing, and I just fell in love with the games, and I just kind of stuck with it from there. It wasn't until later on my sister got a PlayStation, we started playing those games. And then I my knowledge expanded out of, oh, there's more than one console and a library of games.
I love that naivety of it when you're young. Like we were all there, but yeah, just that one console was the be all end all. And then a cousin or a sibling suddenly gets another one, and it kind of blows your mind and opens up you know, and you would you say you were a bit of a Nintendo fanboy? You know, it was always Mario and Zelda.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always a little bit of a Nintendo fanboy, I think, because it's such a childhood sort of, you know, core memory of me. And I do like other consoles and other games. But yeah, I mean, Nintendo's, I'm always going to be like a little bit of a fan towards them, really.
Absolutely. Same. So what other consoles did you have growing up? Did you move on to the GameCube, or did you kind of take a, you know, did you go down the PS2 route?
Always stuck with the Nintendo side because I loved the characters and everything. So after the N64, I got a GameCube.
Yep.
And then I sold my GameCube so I could buy a Wii, because that was the one where my parents were like, you have to, you know, have your own money to buy this type thing. Yeah. So I did that with the Wii, and then thereafter the Wii U. And that sort of thing. So I've always stuck with the Nintendo era, especially when living at home. My sister, she moved to the PlayStation, so she got a PS2 and that. But then when I was out on my own and everything, I did sort of buy more of a, you know, a all the other consoles, really. I do remember when I was older as well, I did get an Xbox because my friend had an Xbox. We did like our little Call of Duty zombie sort of killing escapades. Yeah. I always found that really, really fun, and Saints Row, but that was like in my mid-teens, really, that I got there.
So did you have much knowledge or did you see many of the old computer manuals as well? Because when I was younger, like I'm a bit older, computer manuals were kind of massively needed, but also they were huge. They were absolutely giant, and compared to something like the N64 manual, which... it was quite big, but quite small. Did you see any of these huge ones?
A little bit. I remember it with The Sims and such. We didn't have like a very powerful PC, but I did remember when I was on the PC and taking over the phone line a lot, that you know, I was interested in it, and so we did get a new PC every so often to play some games. But I remember playing The Sims. And I really tried so hard, if you know of the game, playing that Battle for Middle-earth 2.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Tried getting that sort of work on my PC, which was a chore and a half, really. Because obviously we didn't, you know, I had a GameCube at the time, sort of didn't need a massively powerful PC. But I do remember they looked lovely. Star Wars Battlegrounds, I think it was. Battlegrounds 2.
I think.
Like Age of Empires sort of game.
Yeah. What's that one called? I know which one you mean. I can't think what it's called now. I'm getting. It's not Battlefront.
It's like an RTS.
Yeah, it's an RTS. I think it might be Battlegrounds. But yeah, no, that game's excellent.
Battlegrounds,
as well.
I think, is in my brain. But yeah, so those games, they worked fine. And I remember them. I think they had like some nice booklets and that sort of thing with them.
Yeah, it was hard back then as well, because the kind of, you know, sometimes you'd get pirated games and then you'd have no manuals or documentation and you'd have to kind of work it out yourself, which was always a quite tough thing to do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I remember especially like trying to use those like little walkthrough or guidebooks or something that you'd find in like a magazine that has like a section based on it to try and figure out what the hell I'm meant to do. Or something.
Or ring a premium phone line as well, which
I never
used to
did
be a way to do it.
Yeah, I remember seeing them and I was very tempted. But then my dad was like, you know, never call a 09 number ever. I was like, okay.
Or just never use the phone.
Like, yeah, pretty much.
It costs money. So obviously, you know, you kind of grew up with the N64, which was, if I remember rightly, is the last console to have, you know, the cardboard boxes. Were you much of a victim of parents kind of chucking away cardboard box, you know, game consoles and games with the manuals and stuff like that? Do you think you lost a lot of manuals over the years through that, or think many people might have lost a lot of manuals through that?
I mean, a lot of people probably would have, because the parents would be like, oh, look, this is the game. That's all you need. You know, you don't need to store that somewhere. But strangely enough, I have a lot of my childhood games. I kept the boxes.
Oh, wow.
Now, I will say some of them I wish I handled with better care, but I do have quite a few of them. And some of them I do go like, why did I do this to this one and not to this one? Because, for instance, I got both Castlevanias. And if you know the pricing of them. One yes. is a lot more expensive than the other.
Yes.
For yeah. some reason, my childhood decided to pin the wolf and the little pirate ship on the one that's now really expensive rather than the one that's not so expensive.
Wow.
Like, why did I do this when I was a child?
But, yeah.
But it was really nice that my parents let me keep my boxes. I remember that I had trays of the cartridges, but the boxes were kept like on the shelf, sort of up in the wardrobe and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
That's a good way of doing it, because I know a lot of people are collecting now and they're kind of becoming completionists, and then they're looking for the boxes and they're looking for the manuals because stuff like, you know, Game Boy manuals especially, people just traded the carts.
And, yeah, it's crazy. Especially since
and they've become
COVID
really rare.
Went, like, chaotic.
Yeah, no, I'm really pleased to hear that, you know, my mum, I've said it on the main podcast before, on the news segment before, but yeah, all of my cardboard boxes, Game Boy Advance, SNES, N64, all just got chucked in the bin. They just saw it as cardboard. Just saw it as rubbish, my parents did. They're all just in bin bags, gone, see you later. So
I'm
it's
so
good.
Sorry to hear.
It's good
That's
to
terrible.
Hear. I hear so many people with the same thing. So it's good to hear that, you know, there was a system in your house, which I think is fantastic. Yeah. So what were some of your favorite manuals of the era, of like the retro era? Because of, you know, I used to love like the Tekken manuals, you know, any sort of fighting games where it had all stats about the characters, you know, you'd be on your way home from, you know, Toys R Us, or it'd be Christmas Day and you'd be driving over to your nan's and you're reading the manual and you're reading all the silly things about the age of the characters and stuff like that. Was any that kind of stuck out to you?
Oh, absolutely. I would take them to school. I would, you know, any chance I got really where I wasn't playing the game. And if I was playing that game at the moment of time, I'd be looking at the booklet. I was kind of a little bit weirdly obsessed, I guess. But I loved it. Like, for instance, when I was playing Ocarina of Time or Super Mario 64 back in the beginning, I was on those manuals all the time. And because I loved the story aspects, I loved the artwork that was in them that you wouldn't see anywhere else. You know, to the extent I used to try and scan them in the printer, and then I made like a little clip art library of them. So then I could make my weird little stories, and I wasn't very good at stories, so it was literally like just random words and then a load of pictures, you know, because that's the way my books work. So it was quite funny, like thinking back on that. But yeah,
I think
there was those Smash Bros. I loved looking at that,
yeah,
that sort of manual. And then later on you get, like, you know, obviously you get the GameCube era, and they're all very different and diverse, you know. Some of them were really thick as well. Like, I remember Conker's Bad Fur Day. That was like a differently binded, massively thick manual. But yeah, Diddy's Kong Racing, that was lovely to look at. Loved that game.
Were you a big fan of strategy guides? Because I you know, when you said about taking them to school and stuff like that, me and my friends would do the same thing. We'd take like all our, it was mainly GameCube for us because we were in secondary school when GameCube came around, and we'd take them in and, you know, talk about them and stuff like that. Strategy guides was just like such a huge step up from a game manual. Obviously it's a different kind of setting, I guess, but in terms of the information that was there and the artwork and everything, were you a big fan of them?
Yeah, absolutely. I loved looking at them. I didn't have many because they were quite expensive.
Yeah.
I had more of like the Nintendo Power magazines that had walkthrough sections, as well as a few big strategy guides here and there for games that I was struggling with, really. But yeah, they just look so beautiful and amazing. And funny enough, those are one of the things actually that later on I did not keep, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, I kept the games in the boxes and that sort of stuff. But yeah, the walkthrough guides or the magazines, I think after a while when my room was a bit cluttered and needed a thing, I was like, oh, I'm done with this. You know, this can go somewhere, because I didn't think much of it. I wasn't really a massive reader. I didn't like reading a lot of books. Gaming got me reading.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. So
yeah, you mentioned that you kind of made some like little homemade storylines and you were photocopying stuff. I've seen on Reddit recently there's a trend of people sharing like homemade manuals and people making, you know, covers for games when they were missing at home and stuff. Have you seen any examples of those?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole like Reddit for like, you know, Switch art covers and everything that are different, or, you know, just a whole library of them for different consoles. I'm like, that's so cool. It looks, you know, a lot different, a lot better. And then people make their own inserts, especially when like Breath of the Wild came out, people were making like their own little, here's my notebook of all the things I want to do and keeping my progress and tabs and stuff. And they're all different and diverse. And it was really, really cool. And it kind of inspired me then to go the way I went with how I did some of mine. Mm. But yeah, I've seen it sort of dotted around some people making like little digital versions and digital copies and that. And it's, I do think it's really very unique and it's very clever. And it's very personal to that person as well, because you spent surprisingly a lot of time making it, if you know what I mean. Like, yeah. And depending who makes it, it will always look different from one person to another, how you go approaching stuff and whatnot. So yeah, it's really, really cool when sort of you see that. And it kind of like, you know, I didn't see it too much when I first came. Well, I didn't see any like available that I could get, if you know what I mean. It was mostly here's what I've done at home and stuff. And if I wanted it, I would have to do the whole thing myself, if that makes sense. I couldn't just grab it. But you know, I did start doing something for Super Mario Odyssey at home, just with my home printer and stuff. And then sharing it, other people are like, oh, well, you know, I'd love one and stuff. And I was like, well, I don't mind printing you one and sending it off and that sort of thing.
Well, one thing I loved was, you know, it was kind of like gamers adding their own things in there. So I remember, you know, buying games off eBay and finding cheat sheets like slipped into there or stuff written in the back of manuals as well. Did you find any of that kind of stuff when you were collecting?
Yeah. A lot of games I get secondhand, and especially in the notes page or something. I remember when I got like a GTA game for like, I think it was my Xbox GTA 4, for instance, it was secondhand. And yeah, they had like all this sort of like, you know, little tidbits and secrets in the back, you know, or even on some N64 games, you had the classic sort of like Konami code.
Yeah, or the level codes.
Yeah. And I remember getting the cheat sheet books as well. So then I could write it in, you see. So like GoldenEye, I knew how to make them have massive heads and whatnot, you know.
Yeah.
I was there. I was
there. I was there for that, man. Seen some stuff. So how do you think the disappearance of kind of like physical manuals from modern games is impacting the gaming experience? And when did you kind of notice that we were losing manuals?
Okay, well, I'll go with the second question first, because it's a short one, probably. I noticed it more in the Wii U era. That PS4, Xbox sort of One, Wii U sort of thing, you'd buy it and there'd be hardly anything there. Wii U kind of had a digital manual that they didn't really advertise.
Yeah.
And even that, it was, you had to scroll a lot or figure out something. It wasn't as easy to access. So especially in that era, end of the 3DS era, they didn't really have much, you know, to add. So that's when I sort of noticed it start phasing out. And then obviously you then have the latest generation at the minute, or the current generation. Yeah, they don't have anything at all. You know, you're lucky to get an ad. So
yeah,
it's kind of in AAA especially, it's not there anymore, which is a bit of a shame. They, you know, they obviously say it's environmental and that sort of thing, which I think for a massive company, you can make something environmentally friendly and still have it, you know, with the amount of recycling and reusable stuff we go through nowadays. It's not that, not too much extra for them, shall I say. But I think it's because they'll have longer tutorials. They'll hold the hand more. Because they don't have that barrier in sort of hardware or storage anymore. But that to me then kind of, like, I remember playing Pokemon Legends and all that, you know, I made a manual for that. It was great. But I think it was like a 2-hour tutorial, really, because I was still learning new stuff a couple of hours in.
Yeah.
And I was like, if you have to hold my hand for 2 hours, like, I want to get to the good stuff, you know, like, and that's kind of what a manual gave you. It kind of like, look, this is what this is. This is kind of the backstory. This is what you're getting into. So the tutorial section, if there was any, it would be much shorter. And then you can get into the good stuff. If I'm sort of still going through a tutorial, like a couple of hours in or whatnot, then, you know, I'm kind of lost the interest a little bit, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And I never really looked at it from like that, because for me it was, I completely agree with you, kind of Wii U, Xbox One, that was kind of the first generation where manuals were just, they were done. I remember the back end of like the Xbox 360 and the PS3, we were starting to, you know, the later Call of Duties on those consoles were just coming with a spine card, you know, a card in there with,
yeah, exactly, yeah,
with maybe a promotion on it, like a gun on it or something like that. And all of a sudden these manuals are disappearing. And maybe I just saw it because I'm a collector. It kind of made me furious. I got really angry and I couldn't really get it. And until you kind of telling me about that right now, I never really thought of it or looked at it from that point of view of like, you know, we don't have storage limitations anymore or games hold your hands now. And obviously I'm aware games hold your hands and gaming has changed so much over the last kind of 30, 40 years. But I never really looked at it like that. I was just blinded by rage that we didn't get manuals anymore.
So. Well, also, you did get manuals with some like special editions that they charged a lot more money for, you know?
Yeah, I always thought that was a bit weird.
Yeah.
It's like, if you got something there, include it with everything, you know, if you can.
Mm,
special editions are for like those, you know, statues, coin things and stuff that the normal buyer wouldn't necessarily want or need.
So let's talk about your journey into creating manuals for video games. So you mentioned you kind of like you did the Mario Odyssey one and stuff there. What inspired you to start it? What was tell us this journey then?
That's a very good question. Well, yeah, so it was inspired by just buying a Switch.
Mm.
And I kind of opened up Mario Odyssey to play it. And I wanted to flick through to get an idea of what it was about. But I just opened it up, there was nothing there. And I was like, well, that's a bit annoying, shall we say. So I wasn't too happy about that.
The weird thing about Switch cases is they actually have like a spot to, you know, put a manual in. They've got those little clips in there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I was like, why is there nothing in here? I was like, did mine come missing or something? Am I, you know... Because it was a brand new sealed game. And I was like, you know, surely it wouldn't be like this. But yeah, I had a look and I was like, oh no, there is absolutely nothing. And I thought, well, you know, I was playing the game, I was enjoying it. And I mean, I'm no graphics designer or anything like that. I only dabbled in like Photoshop for like IT Sport or fun and that sort of thing. So I thought, you know, if no one else is going to do it, I'm going to do it. Because then it will make me feel complete. This game is physically complete. And it's also good to look back at the controls because... I did take a break for a little while and kind of forget half of them. So, you know, that's always a good bonus, I would say, to do something. But yeah, but then when, like I said, my hard drive died, I kind of lost interest in it because it took a lot of work to do. And I was discouraged and I kind of, you know, I would rather just buy something that someone else has made and be like, yeah, this is it, you know, the easy way.
Mm.
But no one did. And so I was, so that's led me to making that Super Mario Odyssey one in the first place.
Yeah.
And then when COVID hit, I thought I'd relook at it to see if anyone else did make any, you know, out there. And still, beholder to my surprise, because I had this idea for 2 years at that point.
Mm.
You know, I thought surely someone else has done something at this point.
Yeah.
But yeah, no one else... still was from what I could find or see or do anything anyway, you know, on Etsy or browsing the web and that sort of thing. So I went, you know what? I've learned a bit in the couple of years with my weird Photoshop skills and that sort of thing. And I saw on some of the, because Zelda was out for, you know, quite a few years, Breath of the Wild, and people were like doing these really cool, like companion books and everything looking really fancy. And it was in my brain for like a little while. And I was like, you know what? I really want to make something like that. And I've kind of dabbled in it before. And seeing as there's nothing out there that I can just put in a case, I'll make that while remaking the Super Mario Odyssey one.
Mm.
So I don't lose The Will to Live. Because I still have the booklet physically. It's just there was no digital counterpart, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
So I kind of remade one while doing the other with a... you know, some friends sort of chatting and live streaming and that sort of thing. And then I made both of them and I was like, hey, look, I made one too. And it fits inside the case on like a Facebook group. And then it kind of like people were like, oh, please, can I have one? That's really cool. And blah, blah. And it kind of went from there, essentially.
Mm.
Do you think like the Switch having an actual physical card or cartridge, whatever they call that little thing. Do you think that actually helps rather than having, you know, like an online digital download with stuff like, you know, certain models of the Xbox and the PlayStation 4?
Oh, what, with like the booklets and everything?
Yeah, yeah, creating them. Like, is that why you targeted the Switch?
Well, I targeted it because it's the main console I have and use. I do have like a PS5 and that, but I always find I'm playing Nintendo and Switch a lot more. And I was enjoying the game a lot. So, because I love the art style and everything of some of them, you know, even though I love some PS5 games and some are very unique and awesome, a lot of the AAA ones kind of just look all the same graphically wise, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, it's just really realistic rendering and lighting and all this sort of stuff. And I'm like, it's great, but like, I like the unique stuff. It kind of gets my creative flow sort of in theater and that going a bit more. So I'm more inclined to think probably of making those. Yeah. And then I forgot really what the question was about to answer properly.
No, you answered it. That makes sense. So,
okay.
Can you kind of tell us, like, so how does the process of actually creating the manual go? So you make it in Photoshop, which is great, but then how do you...
I used to, yeah.
Yeah.
Not as much anymore.
Not as much now. Okay, so how does... I guess I'm rolling a few questions into one here, because I've got so many questions about it, and but just, like, I guess I can't try and break it down. So one, how do you get such... good kind of like printing quality? Were you printing them yourself originally, or do you send them off to print? Because of the glossiness kind of finish to them, it's just fantastic, and you wouldn't question, you know, if you opened up Tears of the Kingdom and you had your manual in there, you wouldn't question that wasn't Nintendo's manual. And then my next question is, with some of the newer games, how do you get that information so quickly? So I'll use Tears of the Kingdom again as an example. You know, how do you get so much information about the game? Do you get it before it comes out, or do you just have to swing with it and do it as soon as the game comes out, buy it, and then start making it?
Okay. Yeah. So to answer those two questions, to go with the printing side, originally when I first started, they were done on my home printer. Using paper, I kind of tried to match with like the GameCube manual print, like paper, and the N64 manual paper that I had. So I was working on a comparison, and I bought like a few different samples off like Amazon or something. I went, oh, I think this kind of goes with this or this, because paper has different shines and also has different thicknesses. And then depending what you're printing really now is like so much of one color or so much ink will then bleed through to the other pages. And you kind of don't want that, because then you get a bit of a ski whiff. In ink levels. So, you know, I was always cautious. I wasn't always cautious back then, but I am now. But I was trying to just to match like the feel. Like when I open up an original, an official one, and I go like, yeah, this feels great when you open it up. I was then trying to like staple at home little like booklet cutout things and be like, does this feel okay? You know, how does this thing? And basically at home, before the hard drive crash and all that sort of thing, they were done by a home printer on some paper, and I just cut it out with scissors and that sort of thing. Getting some really sharp, good scissors. when COVID hit and I was like, I want to do this properly, printing was one of the things I really wanted to look into doing, because, you know, you can have great design, but if you have an awful print, it just looks awful. And that's what I found with my home printer. It didn't have the quality that I was after. So I learned pretty quickly that home printing isn't the way really to do it, unless you have a big machine. And I was trying to talk to many people, get in contact and that, and be like, hey, you know, local around here and that. And I said, hey, you know, like I'm trying to print like this size and try and do this sort of thing. And a lot of the companies out there, they're like, oh, it's too small. You know, don't. You know, we won't bother with that. And I was like, oh, okay. And then, yeah, one said, I think we can help you out. You know, we'll have like a little test and that sort of thing. And I said, okay, cool. And I said, this is what I'm trying to do. And talking to them, I learned a lot on print.
Yeah.
Because with printing, you have like bleeding and creeping and all this sort of other stuff that you have to be aware of when you're making the thing. Mm. Like, for instance, because at the time, I essentially doing Photoshop and just making an image, and that was it. And then I'd print that image and cut around it to like really close quarters, you know, my scissors or something. But then I learned like, you got to expand more that no one's going to see, essentially, to make it work so that it looks flawless when you cut it and all that sort of stuff. And then depending on the thicknesses, it then all moves and stuff magically. So I was like, okay, this is stuff I've got to be aware of. And then I was like, what about paper? You know, I was like, because I only knew of matte and gloss.
Yeah.
Majorly. And they were like, there's so much more. And we went through and I had samples of them to feel and open it. I was like, you know what? This feels like the premium paper I want to work with. It's not shiny. It's not gloss. It's not matte. It's like an in the middle one.
Mm.
And it's, it's a reasonable thickness. You know, you can get a little bit thinner, but you don't want to go too much thinner with it. And so it feels nice, hopefully, when you open it up and you flick through, that it's like, yeah, everything, you know, feels like a solid booklet, really.
Yeah, that's awesome.
An item. So they helped out with that, and they would print out, and then I'd get it, and I'd be able to, later on I got one of those big cutter, industrial cutter things. So they have like a really nice clean cut that can go through many pages perfectly and that sort of thing. And sometimes the printers, they can partner to do a bit of that process as well
on
like bigger orders, shall we say, because you know, they also said like, these aren't, you know, if you're going to use us or let us have these machines up, like you have to like have a good number. Whatever I was saying is like, oh, this is as max as I would ever have it. They were like, that's a really small order. You know, I was like, but please. So they were like, you know, the bigger it is, the cheaper it is and easier it is going to be for you and everything. Because the machine are the proper industrial ones. They cost a lot to run.
Yeah.
So to get my little sheets of paper through on the paper to make it feel good, to make it look good, you know, it is a cost. So I have to make sure I've got like a good enough number for it to kind of make it worthwhile. Because if I was going to do one on its own, it's like 40 quid or 50 quid just for one.
Yeah.
You know, whereas if I do like, you know, sort of 100 or so, it's not 40 or 50 quid for that one. It's like considerably lower because they just go through the run, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Because it's the machine's already on, cutting them, printing them, etc. So I absolutely understand that. If you print 100 or 1,000 of them, the more you print, the cheaper it becomes to I completely understand that. So because that's really interesting, but how do you, you know, with Metroid Prime, would you revisit the old Metroid Prime manual and kind of borrow from that or like remake it? Or is it all kind of from scratch? And, you know, like with some of the newer games that have never had a manual before, such as Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom, do you have access to the information or do you just have to kind of go at it yourself? What's the journey there?
Yeah, so you kind of said it. I do basically a bit of both. I always play the game to get a feel for it, have an understanding of what would kind of fit best from my experience or what I would like if I was going to, you know, buy something or have something with the game. And for ones like Link's Awakening, Skyward Sword, Metroid Prime Remastered, you know, having the old reference material and trying to recreate that is amazing. You know, it's so good to be like, this is what it looks like. I'm going to try and make it look like this, but I'm also going to try and modernize it like the remake did.
Yeah.
So, which, you know, you think, how can you do that a little bit in a way? But it's a weird one. Essentially, for Link's Awakening, the whole sort of like blue sort of theme of the game in the remake, I applied that to the manual rather than the like red Game Boy sort of manual.
Yeah.
But then also, like, I recreated all the original screenshots
Yeah.
in game to suit the screenshots that they had in the old manual. And, you know, using the new art style, they released like some lovely like Link character artwork that they never did anything with. So I included that in the manual to be the control section and everything, because it's Link, you know, doing all those cool actions and stuff. So
yeah,
you know, it's kind of like all the original material for those sort of ones are kind of there, and you like side by side you can see like, oh yes, you know, there it is, that's it, if you know what I mean, that's the old manual. But it's got a new modernized sort of like, you know, this is the remake though. And with Metroid Prime, you know, there's areas where some of the backgrounds are like really blurry because they're low resolution. So I've kind of like being able to use sort of tools and sort of ways to like upscale and recreate them a little bit to suit some of the concept work for the enemies and that sort of thing, rather than the low poly ones and stuff.
Yeah.
So it kind of blends a lot better. It's stuff like that for those ones. And other games like Breath of the Wild, that's all about exploration. So when everyone else was making mini companions, I thought that would suit better.
Mm.
And also I had it on my phone and I kept deleting the data every time I cleaned out my junk. So it was really frustrating. I was like, I want something where you can just open it and it's there and I can continue from where I left off.
Yeah.
But Metroid Dread, I inspired that from the old SCNS manual.
Yeah.
The old SNES one. Big side Metroid text and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But playing the game, you know, especially looking at stuff like the UI, you know, how the loading screens and that sort of thing look, it gives me an understanding of like, you know, this is what they're after, if that makes sense. You know, this is how they make it function. And so the manual or the booklet kind of reflects the look of that with the game, so that hopefully when it's complete and it, you know, you flick through it, it doesn't have that disjointedness. It's kind of like it looks as official as it could be while being unofficial.
Yeah, it does. Like I said, I've said it before and I don't want to sound like I'm brown nosing too much, but you wouldn't doubt it was from Nintendo if you got that in Metroid Dread. And I think you've captured that so well. And I think it's amazing how quick you get them out as well. Like, I'd still be working on it right now. Like, Metroid Dread's been out a while. So yeah. Is there, do you have any sort of plans? Because one thing I used to love, along with manuals, and maybe this is a little bit more SNES era, so I might be going a bit too old school for you, but you know when you used to get maps and kind of like storybooks with your games as well, you know, often you would get, and maybe GTA is a good example, where you'd get a map of the entire, you know, world that you're playing your game in and stuff. So I guess like Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom would be good for that. Have you got any sort of plans to do that kind of stuff in the future, or is that maybe a little bit too much?
I have dabbled a little bit. It's kind of hard to, like, I love good big maps, and I remember some of them, like Skyrim, being like a fabric map, and I thought that was really cool too.
Yeah.
And yeah, so with some of them, for instance, like the Fire Emblem Three Houses one, I thought it'd be really cool to have like a sort of map with it. But the cost of trying to get that sorted, it didn't seem too great overall. Like, I would lose or like make nothing really.
It was too much of a
gamble if I included it for free.
Mm.
And then if I had like 100 of them or something made and then had to charge like an amount to make it bearable, you know, okay.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone would really buy them.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of that weird thing of like, if I was like a proper, you know, the company people and I could get it vastly cheaper and discounted, it would be great. But at the minute, I haven't really found anywhere to do it well. In the sense of like, it's not just a piece of paper.
Yeah.
You know, because you'd want it to be something that's like something different than you can do at home, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
What's the response from the community been like towards your work? And I was wondering if you had any odd requests as well to do like custom manuals for people.
It's been absolutely crazy. It's been like crazy in a sense of like so heartwarming and just overwhelmingly amazing. Like, never expected it at all. The moment it sort of like started and then this journey started, everyone's just really been so, you know, so welcoming, so loving and everything, like yourselves as well. You know, when you say, you know, because I try and do the best I can with them. And then when you say they do look, you know, like they fit well and stuff, like the goal that I was trying to kind of make is there. It just fills me up with so much joy and stuff, because, you know, it's like that's the highest praise that I could ever get, if you know what I mean. Like something that is, you know, something I've made looks official type of thing, if you know what I mean. The whole community has been so loving, so welcoming. I mean, you get the odd one or two that start going with the, you know, Nintendo lawyer sort of aspect and stuff, or
I was going to ask about that, Office. Actually. Yeah, so Nintendo are quite aggressive. Have you had any stuff from them at all? Or what's your plan with that?
I think when I made quite a few, I kind of wanted to send them an email saying like, hey, you know, is it okay if I do this type of thing? But I never got a reply like years ago. So I kind of, to the best of my ability and friends, we looked up our UK laws and that sort of stuff here. And the area of where I'm trying to hit with them should be okay. Like, I'm no certified lawyer and that, but I've spoken to some solicitors and that sort of thing, and they haven't told me, oh my God, never speak to us, blah, 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 and that sort of thing. So I only assume that's good to hear. The same sort of understanding is there. Essentially, it only bases solely, though, because I make them custom. There's no official material, for instance. So if Nintendo started making manuals again, I would have to stop, or I couldn't make one for that game, if that makes sense.
Well, I was wondering, have you been approached by any indie game studios to produce manuals for their titles? Because there's a lot of like indie titles that are starting to go out on the Switch.
Yeah, I have. I've made a couple. There was when Premium Edition Games first started up.
Oh, yeah.
I made the first couple of manuals for their games, sort of as a co-creator. And then there was one for Numbskull recently, or with it was a bunny one with a time machine and that, and I made the manual for that, or the two little manuals for those, which is lovely. And there may be another one in the coming future, but that's non-decided just yet.
Yeah.
So I can't say anything about that. I can't go too much into them because there's NDAs and stuff.
But yeah.
There are, I think, like four or five that I've made for different companies so far, which is really crazy cool, I will say.
Never
expected that in a million years, you know what I mean?
I'm
just a guy that does, okay, thank you for having me.
I mean, for me, it kind of feels that would be the natural progression of it. You know, you're making custom manuals, which are proving popular. The natural progression would be that maybe some indie studios or even a big studio would ask you to help out with them. So I think that's really awesome. So how far afield has kind of like your orders and demand gone? Do you get many orders from like Japan, or is it kind of mainly Europe and UK, or is it kind of all over the place?
Strange enough, it's mainly in the US. It's like 95% is the US and 5% is everywhere else.
That's interesting.
It is really interesting. It's a bit of a shame, really, because one of the things I really try and help with is postage stuff, because postage costs are an absolute pain in the ass, really, to say the least. And obviously the Royal Mail is not the best. Let's go there, you know.
Yeah.
but because over there, if I was based in the US, or I could get it in the US, it, like, you know, you could have like mail for 80p or something, which is all tracked and everything, because it's just internal to the US. Whereas for them, it's like a minimum of £4.20 or something like that, and that's not even tracked. If you want tracked, it's like a tenner, which I think is absolutely insane to get any tracking at all.
Would you ever consider like doing regional variations, like, you know, a Japanese translated one?
I would if there's enough demand for it. I know a lot, like, for instance, a lot of people want like a French version or Spanish and that sort of thing. And that's one thing I really want to try and work on. But for some, because I have 18 now, Do I? How many is that? One, two. No, I'm not going to count. But you know, I have like I have them up on my side on here because I think it was quite nice in the new office. But yeah, but a lot of them, a lot of people would love like regional specific, you know, one French, one Spanish, you know, maybe something like that. And I'm like, that's so great, but I'm not fluent in any other language, which only makes me have to say like, oh, I have to pay someone to translate it, which might be best with like a proper company or something, I'd, you know, but then they pay pennies per a word and some manuals have like 5,000 words in them. So then you're paying like 400 quid for one translation of one manual when you have 16 of them and then all the other stuff to, you know, and it's like, if there's enough demand there, I definitely would never, you know, say no to it. And it's something I'm constantly always looking into because I feel like there could, but I, you know, it's quite a large thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, because translating a manual can, doesn't take up all the time, but you have to reshuffle all the wording and everything to make it fit.
Yeah.
And also then that takes away time of making a new one or something as well. So it's kind of a very fine line of trying to sort something out. I hope I do sort something out, but
yeah.
And then obviously I got postage and everything on top, which is another thing.
I mean, speaking of big projects, and we kind of touched on it earlier on, would you ever consider, you know, a strategy guide, creating your own strategy guide, or would that just be too much of an undertaking, do you think?
I feel like a strategy guide a little bit could stress me out a bit too much.
Mm.
I mean, I know someone, because I worked with their Metroid Dread strategy guide, because they asked me for to do the art assets for it, you know, like the boxes and that sort of thing with their program. And seeing how much, like, you know, text and how much research has to go into it and stuff, you know, I struggled a lot with Tears of the Kingdom trying to get that out. I literally didn't sleep for like 3 or 4 days just playing it because I, you know, if I was doing like a mini companion thing, I needed to know pretty much mostly everything that's in there. And then obviously there's a lot of search of online stuff. And I feel like with a manual, you can have like, because not every manual is perfect. Even some of the old ones have like imperfections and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you can have a revision and that sort of thing to have like a, you know, as 100% as it can be type thing. And you don't have to be 100% in a manual, but with a strategy guide, it's a walkthrough. You have to be correct and 100%. And I feel awful if I had this big book and I charged like 30 quid for it and everything like that, saying this is how you 100% the whole thing, blah, blah, blah. And it's not.
Yeah. You got something in there completely wrong, or one little thing that makes the game 99% complete.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. 99.9. And you're like, oh, for God, you know. And so, yeah, so that kind of would, I think, stress me out a little bit, especially when you're, because with strategy guides, you know, if you bring out a strategy guide now for like Mario Kart, no one's going to really buy it. You got to keep with like the latest games, I think, in that sort of sense. Or maybe Mario Kart because they got the waves and that. But if you know what I mean, like an older game, you know, because, and also then you do have some official ones. So it's like, how do you go about competing with an official strategy guide to have someone buy your strategy guide, if you know what I mean?
I was wondering if you ever considered kind of, you know, looking back at the past and going for maybe a SNES manual and updating it and adding more information in there, like a kind of Redux version for some more vintage systems.
I would love to, but I'm kind of thinking legally wise, I shouldn't or I can't. Because some of the older manuals, they still exist.
Yeah.
And I would be competing with a product that's existed. That is the only problem. I think the only reason why mine work is because there's no official thing in existence.
You're not copying anything or ripping anything off, are you?
Yeah. So if I say like, oh, look, here's my sort of, you know, Super Metroid or Star Fox, you know, sort of manual and that sort of thing, then I'd then be competing with Nintendo's official one, even though they don't sell it anymore.
Mm.
And then they could be like, let's shut you down or something.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of why some projects for some other people might have failed in the past. I'm not sure, because obviously no legality is going up, but it's something I don't want to risk.
Yeah.
Because one of the caveats of where I try and aim them legally wise is that it doesn't affect Nintendo's revenue or anything.
Yeah.
So if I did release something that already existed and they buy mine to not buy whatever they could ever release, then, you know, that would be affecting that, I think, in a negative way, or could be seen as it. So, yeah.
I guess it would be bittersweet as well if I doubt this would happen. But if Nintendo suddenly turned around and said, we're bringing manuals back for all of our Switch games now, it'd be like, okay, that's wicked that they're coming back. But with what you've just kind of said in reflection, it wouldn't be good for business, I guess.
Hire me. I mean, that's what you'd say.
Yeah, that's what you would say. Give me a job.
Yeah, I'd be like, hi, I made a manual. can I work with you? That's what I would try and say first. But then it also would kind of be like really good in a way, because, you know, hopefully that, you know, aspects of me making these or it becoming known, it has got to Nintendo or something to bring them back, you know. Like, otherwise, if no one did it, because, you know, I'm not the only one that does it anymore, which is quite cool, that other people have made other Switch manuals and that sort of thing, which is really, really cool. And it's you know, it would show that, you know, these things aren't missed and people do really want them with their stuff.
So our final question for you is kind of, what's your vision for the future of your shop? And is there any upcoming projects and new manuals you're particularly excited about or what you can tell us about?
Oh, gosh. What am I excited for my shop in the future? I think just to keep surviving, really. That's kind of always the aim. You know, I'll always say when we speak about Nintendo lawyer stuff, like, they're a massive company. They can shut me down at any point. And I hope that I can be in their graces of the good books and keep going. And, you know, hopefully they like what I make and I make more to the best of my ability. You know, I'd love it if I could keep going, making more and having the library grow for people so they can complete their little physical cases and sets. As far as new manuals come, to be honest, I'm at a bit of a catch up with some orders and stuff, so I haven't actually started anything new just yet. But I'm excited for a lot. Like, there's a lot on my list that people suggest for me and everything. I'd love to do like a Splatoon 2 and 3. I'd love to do the Pikmin series. You've got Super Mario Wonder coming out, as well as the new Luigi Mansion 2 and such. You know, so it's they all look great, and I'd love to get to them, you know. So the next one, I don't really know exactly off the top of my head what it would be.
Well, before we end, I was just wondering, how can our listeners find out about your manuals and where can they see them online?
They can see them in two places. They have an Etsy, which is a bit more expensive because of Etsy fees and such, but that is mbpuk.etsy.com. Or they have my website, which has just recently been revamped and reopened, which also houses like events that I'll be at live and everything else, which is quite cool in case they don't want to pay any postage and see me live to pick them up there. And that is mbpuk.net.
Well, Rowan, it's been fantastic having you on.
Thank you.
And long live the manual.
Long live the manual.